You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade. About what to do this week. Since my last episode, the COVID-19 virus has been declared a pandemic, and probably everybody listening right now is feeling the effects of either the virus or the government measures to curb it, or both. I don't feel ready to analyze the situation, at least not publicly here on From Embers. I don't know what I think enough, and I feel like the state and public response is evolving so quickly that I could record an episode today and it would be irrelevant by the time I got around to editing it. Like many people, I'm surrounded right now by a lot of fear. We're living in a very different context than we were living in a few short weeks ago, and I don't think anybody I know is feeling completely like themselves. I thought it might be more helpful to talk about how we might process this than to talk politically about the pandemic and the strange times we're living in right now. I do think it's really important that we find ways to discuss the situation politically, but to do that well, we have to first get a handle on ourselves and our emotions. So I reached out to Parneet Chauhan, a Montreal-based counseling and somatic therapist who I think of as being generally kind of good at feelings. I've seen Parneet speak a number of times in anarchist contexts, and I've always appreciated what she had to say to us all. We talked this time about self-care, anxiety, communication, and how to live through this extremely scary situation individually and collectively. I'm actually really glad I did this. I think Parneet has some pretty great words of wisdom here, and I hope that some of you find something useful in this as we look ahead in this moment of intense uncertainty. Hopefully, in the coming weeks, we can provide some analysis to help us think through what to do about this very unusual situation we're all living in. But this week, it just felt more appropriate to do this. Here's my interview with Parneet.
Okay. Hey, I'm Parneet. I'm originally from Edmonton, Alberta. I'm working out of Montreal, Quebec. I'm a counseling therapist as well as a somatic experiencing practitioner. I identify as a trauma therapist, and I also, when I'm called to identify as a queer woman of color, I'm also an anarchist, and I have a lot of Buddhist practice in my life.
Thanks so much, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I know things are stressful for kind of everybody right now. How are you doing these days?
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling the collective stress. I just got my chart read. Like, one of my friends is getting really deep into astrology, and she was telling me about my moon being in Cancer and how I pick up on everybody's energy. So I'm feeling a lot of like collective stress, but I'm also just feeling a lot of, I feel very well resourced right now, which is something I feel really blessed by, like a lot of safety and grounding in my actual home and in the people that I live with. Grateful that I still have work. And I kind of feel like the last 5 years I've been sort of preparing for something like this. So it hasn't shook me up too bad yet.
And what's your sense of how people around you in the world are feeling right now? What kinds of emotions do you think are people experiencing primarily?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of panic and destabilization. There's a lot of grief of a sense of self or a future vision or identity. I'm hearing a lot of, you know, feelings of loneliness and isolation that feels really overwhelming and intolerable. And then I also hear people feeling really frustrated about not feeling like they're on the same page with maybe their family members or their friends. So there's also the, you know, pendulum swing on the opposite of folks not taking this seriously. And kind of not feeling individually affected by it, so therefore not kind of seeing their collective impact. Mm-hmm. So that's been interesting to kind of navigate, as there's a lot of different feelings and ways in which I think people are managing this global stress.
Yeah, you know, it's a hard thing because I think like we talk a lot about supporting one another, but I don't think we talk a lot about doing that like when we're also feeling that stress. Do you have any like advice for people who are like trying to be there for each other, but they're feeling really bad themselves as well, you know?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think that a big thing that this pandemic is inviting us to do is to actually do less, which is really hard when we live in capitalism and we live in cultures that are obsessed with productivity and meaning making. Like there's so much urgency to fix and repair. So I would say like in feeling, you know, collective grief, or if you're feeling bad yourself, just a recognition that, you know, it's very likely that somebody's presence or somebody's compassion or somebody's active listening or dropping off a meal at somebody's doorstep, sending a funny meme, like whatever it is that you feel you have capacity for. I think the challenge here is, can our mindset recalibrate to seeing it as good enough? Because that's actually the thing that often gets in the way in life in general, you know, COVID-19 or not, is this persistent dis-ease of not ever feeling quite good enough or doing enough. And that's showing up in a really violent way now, where I know a lot of people who have, I would say as extreme as like a savior complex to as mild as, you know, just wanting to help and support and not knowing what they can do. And it's like, we have to recalibrate that what you're doing is probably already enough, even if that's like calling your family members or, your own individual protocols to staying healthy.
That's really interesting advice, I guess, for like my listeners in particular, many of whom are organizers who are used to doing like a million projects all the time. Mm-hmm. In a way, like, those projects are a coping mechanism. Like they're not just work. Yeah. Like they're also like hugely emotionally and socially important.
Yes.
In normal times. So it's interesting to think about that and like how we might use that time to let go a little bit, but not completely. If that makes
sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like as someone that was heavy in organizing for years, it's not about, you know, killing that part off of yourself or, you know, not having value in it, but it's recognizing, like there's a Buddhist word, that I use a lot in my own practice is, you know, being equanimous, right? So the capacity to be okay with the ending, the capacity to be grounded despite the outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so can we be equanimous in our organizing? Meaning, and I'm sure that you know this and folks that are listening know this, which is, you know, sometimes we put so much love and effort into, an event or a demo or, a practice or whatever it is. And then it's like unsuccessful, or something gets in the way, or you don't have the funds for it, or somebody gets sick. And if all of our energy is put in, you know, the quote unquote productivity of it, or in the outcome of it, then the joy of the process is actually lost. And also, I think, especially in this time now, when just it happens to be that the circumstances don't allow for folks to organize in the ways that they're used to, the invitation, I think, is can we be equanimous with it? Doesn't mean that we have to devalue it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does make sense, actually. It's making sense to me. I mean, I don't know if it's making sense to everyone who's going to hear it, but yeah. That's interesting. I want to talk to you more about communication after, but I was going to first ask you about stress, about anxiety. I mean, I think a lot of the ways that I was taught to manage my own fear, my own anxiety, was sort of assume that it was unwarranted. Like sort of go through your thoughts. Are they reasonable? Probably not. Or maybe they are, but you don't want to value them right now or something. But like, I think in this case, a lot of people are experiencing these very real fears. It's like, oh, my parents might die. Let's check that thought. Oh yeah, they actually might, you know, or like, I can't go outside. Oh yeah, it's actually illegal. You know, like there's like, I think there's like something really different about it in many ways.
Yeah.
What do we do with that? Like, what are some mechanisms that we can apply in cases like that, where it's like a situation of like, you know, genuine danger in some cases?
Yeah. I mean, I think the big thing that I've been doing myself, and that I've encouraged people that I'm working with or that I'm in relationship with to do, is to, you know, unashamedly orient and move towards whatever it is that feels safe and whatever it is that feels grounding and comforting right now. Because we can't actually be with the harder emotions if we don't feel present. Mm-hmm. And we don't feel present if we don't feel safe. And so it's a bit of like a cart before the horse. It's like, we want to be able to do this deep work. I mean, at least the people that I work with, they're like, yeah, I want to be able to, you know, like, I work with a lot of activists and folks in organizing communities that, you know, want to be able to show up and mobilize this energy. It's really about how do we mobilize our survival energy right now so that we can be ready for whatever is coming, whether that's the death of a parent or the sickness of somebody, or, you know, I mean, as extreme as like authoritarian or fascist government policies getting snuck under us or whatever, right? So to me, it's like, it can seem counterintuitive to like look outside and notice the clouds and like sip some tea and notice that you have feet and notice that, you know, you have a body and it's safe in this moment. It may not be always, but like the practice of orienting to safety through the senses is such a foundational thing to be able to build bigger capacity to then feel things like grief or rage. But sometimes we kind of jump ahead and we want to be able to feel those bigger things. And the analogy I often use is like, how big is your bowl, right? So if you think about, you know, the bowl is a symbol or an analogy of one's capacity to be present with what is, right? And depending on the effort and the hours and the time and the work that you've put in being present, your bowl might feel very big or very small or somewhere in between. And then there's like the life emotional experience, which has a particular size or a particular charge to it. And, you know, people might find like their bowl isn't big enough to fit or to hold the size of the feeling, you know? And so it's like, one thing is like, just don't judge what you don't have capacity for, right? Like, I think I've said this maybe like three times this week to people. It's like, the revolution has to be embodied. You know, we have to be present for what's to come. And if we're not, then our job, as difficult as it might feel, is to actually work on building a sense of presence. And what's going to do that is actually finding some anchor to safety. Otherwise, why would we be here, right? It makes sense that our mind and our consciousness would want to flee. So that's what I would... At least that's what comes to mind for me, is like, I've been doing a lot of grounding, safety containment practices for people and really like doing it guilt-free and shame-free. It doesn't mean you're selfish. Doesn't mean you're weak. It means that you are wanting your next decision, whatever it may be, to be one where you're a little more present and you're a little more in your body.
Emotions are like really high right now. I think even like out in the street, like even like I feel like conversations with my neighbors are supercharged right now. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us also have things that we have to decide together, like how to relate to different social distancing recommendations or how to respond to like new laws. Yes. Some of us are still trying to do projects and we're trying to maintain relationships with people who we're close to, often over a distance. Like, do you have any strategies for communicating more effectively when people maybe aren't thinking as clearly as we usually do? Besides the advice you just gave to like just ground yourself and try to do it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, one thing is just like slow down, right? Like sometimes when we feel that collective charge, we also, our body system starts to get activated. And, you know, it's not to say that there isn't threat, but can we slow down a little bit? And so maybe that means instead of feeling, if you feel a sense like you have to make a decision about a particular project today, can you, you know, prolong that a little bit and in the time in between do what feels like safe practices so that you don't necessarily have to decide from like a reactive place? And I want to specify that this is different than like avoidance, right? This isn't about, oh, let me avoid that I have to make a decision, which is also a kind of disembodiment, right? But it's to like be able to notice that there's an urgency and what does it look like to, in an embodied way, slow down a little bit, right? Just like piece by piece. Because I think, again, another invitation that this pandemic is inviting all of us to do is really up our communication game. You know, like conversations that people are having around, you know, where they've been, who they've been in contact with, what their protocol is if they do get sick, what their protocol is if they, you know, have to take care of somebody who's sick. Like these are all, I think, just valuable, important questions in general. And this is something that's been brought to light because of the urgency and because of the quickness and the kind of contagiousness of the flu. But even when that wasn't in the forefront of all of our minds, I think conversations around, you know, what is our genuine capacity? What is our protocol if one of us, you know, gets sick? I mean, these are questions that I've had with friends because of like chronic illness that I've had where I'm like, yeah, I might not be able to show up to this thing. Or, you know, I was speaking to a friend months and months ago who was just not like, was not attuned or aware to let me know if somebody in her home was sick. And so I would go over there and I'd find out after like sleeping over or spending the night with her that like, you know, sure enough, she's fighting a cold, that it's on the tail end or her roommate has one. And then I would catch sick because I have a really weak immune system. And so like, it's like just, it was the first time that she had ever had anybody, you know, ask her to inform, you know, the other person of her health condition and of the health conditions of the people in her home. Right. And so, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's just like really kind of reframing and seeing this as an opportunity to get very curious about what are people's comfort levels. They may not always match. So what does the middle ground then look like? Yeah, I don't know if there's like a specific thing that comes to mind when I say that, but like, yeah.
That's interesting stuff. I think it's like, that's a really good point that like some of these conversations are conversations that we, you know, perhaps should have had at a calmer time, or perhaps could still have in a calmer way now if we give them more time, if we wait longer. I think in my communities, at least, like people are kind of extra entangled because of collective living, because of polyamory. Like there's just a lot of decisions to make together because people are kind of all knotted up together. And now suddenly there's this particular thing that I think we're quite vulnerable to. Not vulnerable to getting sick, but like there's just like a longer list of decisions to make, I guess, than like my neighbor seems to have, which is, I mean, I think for her, like, she's like, she lives with her husband, and they are laid off. So the decision is just to stay home, right, and to go out, but to keep yourself distant from people. And I think it's easier to make that choice when it's like, yeah, like, this is my husband. This is the one person who I'm going to relate to. But I think a lot of people I know are sort of like navigating this world where it's like, now they're making all these choices that they would not have had to make otherwise. Mm-hmm. For ethical reasons, I think primarily, mm-hmm, as well as for like maybe personal reasons if they're themselves vulnerable in like various physical ways. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about trying to find ways to have those conversations, but to have them in a way that is in tune with the way people are feeling right now better. Because I think like often, like this, they're not urgent. They don't have to be made in like 5 minutes, but they do probably have to be made this week. Like if someone's telling you like, oh, if you go to the grocery store, like my mom's going to die, you know, like then you have to like make a choice about going to the grocery store or not going to the grocery store at some point, like before you run out of food. I think people, sometimes you do have to make a choice when people aren't feeling well, like when they aren't quite there for the conversation in a way that like would be ideal. And I think it's just really hard to find ways to communicate with each other ethically and carefully when we ourselves are feeling like all the stress that's, I think, in part just like the stress of like the world outside being fed back into us by the media and by the way people around us are feeling, as well as our own fears.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think that, you know, the conversations may not be had or, you know, created in the best of conditions because there's, you know, time urgency, and there's, you know, a heightened sense of our mortality and of death and aging and sickness. And so again, like how to, number one, like contain and create some sense of safety, whether that's like through house practices, if you're communally living, like just to give a bit of context, like I'm in my home with my partner, and then I have two roommates, and then we decided to take in a friend whose partner was coming back from international travel, who we did find out actually a couple of days ago has coronavirus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's my context of like where I'm staying. And you know, I, as soon as I knew that this thing was happening and it was getting serious, I kind of called in on a house meeting, and I was like, okay, what are our agreements, you know? And we really had to like sit together and come up with house agreements. So it's like, okay, these are the protocols of, you know, washing of clothes and washing of hands and like the distance we all feel comfortable. And there was also a conversation around who here has connection with elders and people that, like, I think I have the most kind of immune suppressed system out of everybody in the house. So I kind of named that, and I mean, not to get into the details of it, but basically like long and unfolding conversations around, you know, what we're willing to lose based on what we're willing to gain, or what we're willing to put ourselves at risk for because it's, you know, more important for us to do X, Y, Z. And that's not always going to match for everybody. You know, some people are willing to put themselves at risk with the understanding that they may catch this flu because to them, what's more important is being able to have and hold their partner with them. And for others, that might not be the case. And so it's really like an invitation for everybody to own what's true for them and then trying to make the most, I don't know, self-respecting decision while still respecting that others may not match that. Mm-hmm. Right. And sometimes that can put us in really difficult places. Like, I feel very grateful that everybody in our house was essentially on the same page around, at least in-house, practices. But I also, you know, had to have a conversation with like my partner and my friend who both are doing projects outside of the house because that feels important to their mental health and they want to be able to work on things. I'm like, okay, well, that's a thing that, you know, puts me at risk, let alone my mom, who is somebody that I do actually want to keep in contact with, right? And so we're just having to keep having these conversations as they unfold, because I think something that's important is recognizing, like, we've never been here before. This is, you know, new negotiations. There's no blueprint for us on how to move forward collectively. And so trying to just keep a lot of compassion in our heart and a lot of open dialogue, and to keep kind of checking in and keep asking how these negotiations are feeling. But the one thing I can say, at least in the house that I'm in, is that everybody is doing the work of orienting to safety, whatever safety means for them. Right. And for some people, that means like going for really long walks. That personally doesn't make me feel more grounded and safe. For me, it's like being in my home. I'm very much like, in, you know, wanting to stay and nest in my place. It's like, for me, it's like organizing my bookshelf or whatever. And for my partner, that's not helpful at all to them. Like, they would rather like work on the backyard and be in the dirt. And for my other roommate, it's like going for super long walks for like hours. And so everybody's, I'm grateful that everybody in our house is sort of taking ownership of what's supporting their individual system to feel safe, so then we can all come together collectively in a little more grounded way to have these tougher talks that are very scary and are very, they're not going to be perfect. They're not going to be perfect conversations. People are at risk, regardless, you know, and how can we kind of show up with the most integrity so that we feel, we really think through, do we feel okay with the decisions that we've made or are about to make?
Yeah, that's, thank you. That's useful. I think you and I are kind of lucky in many ways to live with people through the situation. I also live collectively, and I feel like I have a lot of people around me through this.
Yeah.
I've spoken to lots of people who I think are already experiencing or expecting to experience some like quite profound and unprecedented loneliness through this period. Maybe because they live alone or because they're choosing to live alone for like health or emotional reasons right now. Do you have any ideas about how folks like that can handle that? Like sort of how to be with yourself in ways that are healthier if we're not accustomed to being alone so much?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so hard. I mean, I just want to share, like, I am extending so much compassion out to people that are feeling that isolation, not only on an emotional level, but on the physiological level too, of like the power of being able to touch somebody or be touched. You know, we are social beings at the core, and our physiology is meant to be where it's very like, you know, I don't like to use the word natural a lot, but it's like a natural human need to be held, to be touched, to be hugged. You know, it's one of the reasons, like, you know, the kind of most violent form of torture is isolation. So first, I just want to say, like, yeah, it's incredibly painful. And to have a mindset of oneself, to just say, you know, in this kind of self-compassionate way, like, this is a moment of suffering. This is very painful for me. It's not my fault, right? To not let shame kind of eat away at the experience, but to soothe that experience, first of all, with just a mental state and a mindset that one that is compassionate, right? I do a lot of metta, a lot of like loving kindness meditations, either towards myself or towards the people I work with. It's like, you know, this is a moment of suffering. This will pass. It is not my fault that I'm alone. I'm deserving of love and care from others. May I receive love and care from others in the ways that I can right now. You know, to be really creative about how can you speak to yourself and relate to your, to like, this is more of a mind practice. So it's not necessarily the physiology, but I'll get to that. But, you know, being mindful of not letting shame get in the way of actually honoring and loving yourself through this really difficult time. Right. And so shame might say something like, what's wrong with me? I should be self-reliant. Why am I so lonely? I'm such a loser. You know, or why did I choose to live alone? Or like whatever horrible things shame might convince you of believing. It's like, no, this is really not the time. And so that's a big one. Replacing shame with self-compassion and really being like, ouch, this is a painful moment. This sucks for me. And it's not my fault. And then I think the other thing is, you know, getting really curious, you know, once we can put shame aside, we can start to get curious about what the body actually responds positively to, right? So it might be like you know, you might bake cookies for yourself and just like smell fresh baked cookies, you know, and like have a couple and enjoy them, right? It's, and you might have a really warm or soft sweater that you like to wear, or you might offer yourself, you know, a bath or give yourself a hug. So there's a big, big opportunity here for leveling up in our, you know, self-touch and self-support. And for some people that can feel really cheesy and it can feel really foreign and fake and strange. But this is, I think, the, you know, the invitation, if you're willing to take it, is like, okay, how do I really offer myself loving and supportive physical touch? It could be, you know, giving yourself a massage, massaging your hands or your feet. You know, giving, if you, you know, are into like facials or, you know, trying out different things that feel soothing or comforting on the body. But yeah, this is like, I think, a big challenge for a lot of people. And it's not to say it's the same as, you know, your friends hugging you or your partner hugging you. It's not about trying to find the same sensations or the same sense of goodness that you would have with your primary people in your life. But it is to say, okay, I'm going to be curious. I'm going to experiment with how my body responds when I offer it something sensation-based to let it know that I'm here, I'm present, I'm grateful, it's still breathing, it's still circulating blood, my heart is still pumping. You know, and even just like bringing your awareness to your body and your awareness being with a, you know, like a gentle, loving gaze can have huge impacts versus, you know, the feeling of loneliness sometimes makes us want to run away from ourselves. And so how can we lean in lovingly and say like, ouch, yeah, this is, I'm feeling lonely, you know, and you might even feel called to place your hand on your heart where that loneliness is, you know, or give yourself a hug or wrap yourself up in a blanket. Yeah. So those are the two main ones, is like speaking to yourself and, you know, relating physically to yourself in a loving way, in this painful, isolating time.
Hmm. I don't like to use the word cheesy, but I'm glad you acknowledge that for some people it can feel hard to start these kinds of practices or even to like admit that they need them.
Yeah.
I wonder if like for folks who are sort of, I think a lot of folks are sort of like discovering that they need kinds of care that they haven't had to voice needing before. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have, if there are ways that you've seen people like get past that sort of first barrier that are helpful. If it does feel like, oh, I could just never say that to myself. I could just never do that. Like, I just don't, you know, if there's any advice you'd have for people who are like, they know they're feeling bad, but they're not quite ready or like prepared to talk to themselves in these terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would just invite folks to imagine their friend or their closest loved one suffering through what they're suffering through. Just imagining that they switch places with somebody else and what they'd want to say to that person. What they'd want to say to that loved one who is feeling really alone and feeling really scared and is missing physical touch and, you know, whatever experiences they're having, if they imagine that their loved one, their most like precious person in their life is experiencing that, what they would tell that person, how they would physically respond to that person. Would they give that person a hug? Would they want to scoop that person up and hold them? Would they want to make them a cup of tea and tell them that they love them? And to really just practice saying it to the other person. And then from that place, can you imagine saying those things to yourself? You know, and maybe you can't say it out loud, but could you write it on a mirror in your bathroom? Could you leave a little note on your fridge? Because we often do have the capacity to have so much compassion and love for other people. And then again, shame gets in the way in offering that to ourselves. And so a big, big obstacle that I'm seeing is shame right now, is a lot of shame rearing its ugly head as people are, you know, experiencing suffering. And it's almost like a double suffering. You know, there's a Buddhist saying of like, avoid the second arrow. The first arrow is the painful experience, right? The pain of loneliness. for example. And then the second arrow is the judgment and the shame of that first experience. Right. And so can we avoid the second arrow? Can we just put shame aside long enough so that we can be curious about the first experience, which might be like, I'm lonely. You know, I miss my partner. I miss my friends. Like my body feels deprived of touch. And I think, you know, and yeah, it might feel cheesy, maybe lean into that. Like, I remember when I started getting into self-compassion stuff, like I grew up in a like super working class immigrant family. It was like very little physical touch, you know, that stuff was seen as super cheese and, you know, at times even like inappropriate. And like, it was very uncomfortable for me to start speaking to myself in a loving way. Like my shame voice was so much louder and so much more like violent and prominent, and just had to slowly but surely and patiently and lovingly chip away at it and say like, well, that's not very nice. That's not very nice that I'm saying that to myself. That's actually really mean. And, you know, can I place even a hand on my shoulder? Can I hold my own hand? Can I give myself a hug? Just like you would with somebody that you love. I've never worked with somebody. I've never met somebody who wasn't able to, you know, answer quickly what they would do if their favorite person in the world was experiencing pain. It's like they're able to access that compassion right away. So how to bring it back to yourself? Because this is a time where that might be really important.
You are listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you might be listening to the podcast edition of From Embers on the internet, that place where we now all of a sudden seem to spend the majority of our collective time. This week, I'm talking to Parneet Chauhan about the pandemic, how people are feeling right now, and how we might be as good as possible to ourselves and each other through this crisis. Ain't got no name, ain't got no fancy education, but I can see right through a powder face on a painted fool. Let me slip through. Why you trying to hold me back? I'm just trying to move up front, little more this, little less of that.
Watch the ankles break. Whoa, whoa. I know you wish, I know you wish I would fade away, but I got more to say. Lord, they pray. Good thing, got a bad, bad news. All day I
you know, it might feel really weird to be asked to notice what's happening in your body. And it might feel really unsafe because I think part of what colonization has done, right? Like if we want to bring that in because we can't not bring it in because it's everywhere, is to separate the mind from the body and is to really pedestal the mind and make decisions from the mind. But that is what colonialism has done, right? Is very disembodied, separated from the body, separated from the earth, which is also a body, and making decisions and justifying horrific decisions from that place. And so when we talk about, you know, if you speak about decolonizing in your communities, or if the people that are listening in are trying to do active decolonizing work, truly a big step towards that is noticing your own body, noticing that you have a body, and that that body actually needs nourishment and air and water. Because I think, you know, with what's happening in different places in the world and Indigenous solidarity projects, it's like, is really trying to get people to wake up and recognize you're not separate. And colonization and colonialism as a mental, I would say, dis-ease as a mental state is one that really believes in the separation between mind and body, self and body, body and earth. And so even though sometimes like somatics or, you know, noticing your body, giving your body some love and attention can feel like woo-y stuff, is actually very, it's a political act to be like, oh yeah, I have a body and I need the earth the way I need my body. Otherwise I don't exist. I don't exist. The mind doesn't exist in this floaty realm above your body. It exists in your brain, which exists in your body. And the only reason your brain actually works is because your heart is pumping blood all day and your body is circulating that blood up into your brain. And that's that's science, you know? So it's frustrating sometimes when these things get, you know, reclaimed or appropriated in like hippie sort of wooey language, because it's like, okay, that's fine. I'm not like dissing that, but also like it's just reality that you have a body and you need it to function and live. And that's so apparent now. The interconnectedness of our bodies is so apparent now with the pandemic. I mean, that's what the crisis is about. So yeah, I just wanted to add that angle as well, that this isn't that separate from, you know, organizing and political work. It's actually deeply important to remember that we first have to decolonize our own mental state and recognize that we're not just our minds and we can't just make decisions from our minds. I mean, if we do, we might actually be perpetuating the very thing that we're trying to get away from.
I guess on the flip side, like some of us who perhaps will not feel lonely as much or will feel lonely in different ways, I think a lot of us feel kind of like locked in together, if that makes sense. I think a lot of people are fighting. I can hear my neighbors fighting more than usual. You know, like I've already been in like a couple of silly conflicts that I know better. Like I know I shouldn't be in, but I think it's just like we're in close quarters, a lot of us, and we're seeing each other actually like more and in different ways than we're used to. And we don't have these like routines that we had of like work or study or seeing other people out of the house as much as we once did.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can speak a little bit to how we could try to maintain that compassion for each other when we're kind of feeling both stressed out on a personal emotional level and kind of like perhaps somewhat like sick of each other despite love, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I'm going to be very like Taurus right now and just say like, keep your routines, you know, really, really self-discipline, I think is so important right now for two reasons. One, because the day can be this boundaryless place, and also because the internet is already this boundaryless place, right? So you might be getting loads of very activating, charged, violent, scary information. And then that's being held in your body and you're trying to process that, you know, charge and that energy while you're trying to also connect and relate to the people in your home, right? So, yeah, I think, you know, what you were saying about like, you know, that you're better than the silly fight that happened, or like sometimes it's not even about the thing that you're fighting about, but it's the energy coming through that actually has nothing to do with, you know, who left the towel on the table or whatever, but it has to do with like an underlying feeling of panic or overwhelm or feeling of being smothered. something that's worked really well in my house, and I mean, I can't vouch for it working for everybody, is like we've all maintained our own individual schedules, whatever that looks like. And so if you have been laid off, if you no longer have work, what is something you can replace that chunk of time with that provides you some sense of meaning? Maybe it's a project that you've put on hold because you didn't have the time. You know, maybe it's like you want to get a little more physically active. And so you spend an hour or two, you know, doing yoga and working out or whatever your version of, you know, physical fitness is. Maybe it's like, you know, you want to learn a new recipe. Maybe it's like a book that you didn't, you know, get a chance to ever read because you've been too busy doing a million projects and now you can actually read it. So really, like, you know, keeping some kind of schedule and maybe even making that schedule visible so that when the chaotic, windy, watery energy starts to come around, you have a little bit of earth to kind of guide you and be like, okay, yeah, actually from 9 to 11, this is like my general 1 to 3 things that I want to accomplish. And then, you know, maybe chatting with the people in your house is like something you do only at dinner time in the evenings. That, which is like an example of what's happening in my house. Everyone's really doing their own thing during the day. We kind of get together around tea time at like 4:35. And then we're busy until about 7, and then we meet up again and we have like a chat about how everybody's doing. So limiting the time that you process and talk, number one, and really respecting your own individual schedule that works for your own mind-body system, which again is going to be based on things like your personality. You know, are you a high extrovert? Are you a high introvert? Are you somewhere in the middle? Are you more of like a physical tactile person? Are you more of an emotional person and you need like time to write and journal? So not letting enmeshment and a kind of codependency patterns that sometimes are like, you know, starting to play out, being mindful about that and seeing, okay, is there a way we can all scale back and you know, find the places where we do come together, and also, you know, are your own individual practices starting to slip because there's a lot of shared energy in the house that persuades you to not do that one thing that you know is good for you?
I guess you mentioned the internet a couple of times. I know this isn't actually like your expertise to comment on or whatever, but I think a lot of us are spending more time on screens than we ever have before.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any, like, is there anything you're personally doing to manage that, but not cut off from it, or like advice you have for people who are sort of allowing themselves to spend more time on the internet than perhaps we would usually allow ourselves to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that one thing is just being really cautious about the information that you're receiving. It's not to say don't be informed, but if that drive to be informed comes from a place of urgency, like that's going to be so taxing on your system. And also, you know, I think one of the things that's beautiful about technology right now, not necessarily the internet, but like having Wi-Fi, for example, is that we can use it to support connection. Like the fact that you and I are speaking right now is because there is Wi-Fi available on both of our ends and we have the technology to connect. And this is going to be a lot more nourishing for me than is if I was to spend these last 41 minutes, you know, reading about the various theories about coronavirus. And again, it's not to say that it's not important to do that, but to set boundaries with yourself. Because that's one of the struggles with the internet in general, is like there's nobody setting boundaries for us. It's a really like it's the wild, wild west out there. So you could pretty much find anything and you could go on it for as long as you wanted. And there's really nobody stopping you. So, you know, how to bring in a little bit of self-love and self-discipline of, okay, what amount of, you know, time reading about this is actually doable for me. And again, your body is a really great guide in that, right? Like if you, let's say, set a timer for 20 minutes and every 5 minutes, there's a ding that goes off that kind of prompts you to check in with your body. And you might ask yourself, do I have the capacity to keep reading for another 15 minutes? There's bound to be some information, some feedback loop that your body's going to give you. You know, are your eyelids getting heavier? Are your eyes becoming strained? You know, is your throat parched because you're dehydrated? Is your stomach clenched because you actually came across a really terrifying piece of news? And so, you know, in a way, like the internet is giving us all this information, but on the other hand, it very like insidiously results in a kind of numbingness and a disembodiment. And I just don't know how helpful that is, how helpful it is to have all this information when we don't actually feel present. Right? Like they often say like knowledge is power, but I think like I want to nuance that a bit and say like knowledge is power when it's embodied, when we actually can mobilize that information. If we feel overwhelmed by it, then we're going to go into freeze and we're going to want to hide in our bed and sleep for 12 hours, right? Which is actually a normal response because we're in freeze. So again, sometimes our like brains are like, no, I've got to be really informed, but it's like, actually, we have to respect what our body's capacity is in order for that information to be of service to our entire sense of being. So I know it's kind of a roundabout way of saying it, but like what I would suggest very kind of directly is like set limits to the amount of information you're receiving and set intentional time to technology and the internet being in service of connection. Because we're lacking the physical connection, like, you know, having phone chats on the phone and really being able to hear your friend or your person's laughter, being able to talk about things other than the coronavirus, like you might really need to facilitate with your friends, like, okay, we're not going to actually speak about this. You know, can someone talk about something else? Like, I don't know. I've been reading a friend like a bedtime story, and my friend just now that called is a different friend that read me my astrological chart in great depth, you know? So to get creative about what we can bond over right now, is I think important as a usefulness of technology and of the, having the access to, you know, Wi-Fi or the internet now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to differentiate that, I guess, like between connection versus information gathering. I think so much of the internet like tells us that it's one thing, but it's actually the other, like various social media platforms that like perhaps we use in the name of connection also slip in like so many news stories and so many things that are, I think, more akin to what you're talking about, like more like gathering knowledge or information. But you're right that Wi-Fi can also totally bring us that kind of one-to-one conversation. Like I know I've been catching up with friends who I haven't spoken to that much in like years this week because we have more time and we can, and because it's nice to like bounce ideas off a new person right now.
And
to me that feels like quite categorically different from just like scrolling through a feed or reading the news. So I appreciate your division of those two things. That's useful for me.
Yeah. And like, again, I think that your body will give you information as to what the impact of that exchange is, right? So if it's a one-sided exchange of you're receiving a lot of information, so it's almost like you can imagine little invisible arrows from your screen going towards you, right? That's really different than, you know, a conversation where there is like, you know, little invisible energy arrows going back and forth, like the way that I kind of feel when I'm chatting with a friend, or like the fact that I'm speaking with you right now, right? There's a different presence to that versus the scrolling that you were talking about, where your presence isn't really monitored, you know? You can be really, I mean, I think we all can catch ourselves being pretty numbed out by that stuff, but we're still scrolling.
Yeah. I guess like I wanted to ask you if there were any particular practices or narratives or like things that you'd like to offer to people who are getting through this that maybe they haven't tried before, like new things or old things that we could try to help us through hard times.
You know, many, many years ago when I was supposed to like start working, I decided to not work and I was so burned out. And I remember I knew that I couldn't start working, and I had thankfully done enough self-compassion work that I didn't like feel ashamed that I couldn't. And so I just really honored that I was going to spend however many months not working and figuring out what I was going to do with my time. And I ended up taking French classes. And because of that, I was getting like a very little government kind of subsidy or aid. So mm-hmm. I lived off of that for like 6 months because I just like was not mentally and emotionally well enough to do the work. And I wanted to honor and respect what was happening. And, you know, when people asked me like what I was doing with my life or what I was doing with my life, people were like, how are you? What are you doing? And my answer was like, I'm learning to be a human being again. Because I really was like, we suddenly have an abundance of time. And this is reminding me of this time that I had like about six, seven years ago when I didn't work full time or even I would say part time for like 6 to 9 months. And I learned how to, you know, be a human again. And that looked like, you know, being more mindful about my cooking and cleaning practices, my own personal hygiene, organizing my space, getting curious about, you know, what kind of music I actually liked, writing poetry, being bored out of my mind, and like just like learning to be bored as like a tolerable, normal experience. And, you know, I would say that I think that's probably what's challenging for a lot of people right now is not really knowing how to live and exist without doing something all the time. And it's terrifying. Like I think the experience that I had back then and the experience that I continue to have as I deepened in that practice, of doing less was this kind of existential dread. Like who the f- am I when I'm not organizing? Who the f- am I when I'm not working? Who am I when I'm not, you know, going to school or I'm not a student? And that's a really profound and important question because there is still somebody there. It's not like you evaporate and you disappear. But I found that I got to the essence of who I was without all of the doing. And so that's what comes to mind in that question that you asked is like, can we see this as an invitation to reclaim our humanity on being human beings that have the birthright to be, you know, safe and loved and supported and checked in on even when we're not producing? And that might be really difficult. It might be really, really difficult to have an embodied sense of like, yeah, I'm deserving of a beautiful day and a delicious meal and a safe, warm bed when I haven't done anything to quote unquote deserve it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is, I think, what unlearning capitalism and unlearning our obsession with productivity is about. So that whatever we decide to do really comes from a deeper sense of choice rather than obligation or shame, which often can propel us to do the projects we do.
Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you were hoping to talk about today?
I don't think so. No, I really appreciated your questions. And yeah, I hope that I was able to offer something to everyone that's listening. Yeah, just wishing everybody a lot of safety and peace. Yeah, and sending everyone, you know, just like slow and grounded energy in the days and weeks to come.
Around my neck, I'm taking my freedom, putting it in my car.
Join us for KiteLine, a weekly radio program on Channel Zero Network that focuses on issues in the prison system. With over 50 episodes already released, you can hear informative and riveting stories about the impact of prisons on people both inside and outside of the prison walls, and how they fight back.
KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. Our goal at KiteLine is to amplify the voices of those within the prison system while encouraging dialogue with those on the outside.
Hear us on the Channel Zero Network and visit our website for more information or previous episodes at kitelineradio.noblogs.org.